Good morning and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Today's question, why can't we provide quality early childhood care and education at the scale we need? It came from a listener, a working parent who finally has survived his own child's years in an expensive child care center here in Anchorage. But as he put it, 90 expensive spots in one child care center is not solving the much larger problem here in Anchorage. He asked us to do a program on why parents pay so much for child care, why there is so much unmet need, and yet why are child care workers among the lowest paid workers, so low paid they often can't afford child care for their own children. We turn to our panelists to help us understand this complex issue on a very local level here in Anchorage, and hopefully point toward solutions our listeners can consider. So let me welcome Stephanie Berglund. She is CEO of THREAD, a nonprofit here that advocates for quality child care, working with parents, working with caregivers, and working with communities. So Stephanie, welcome.
Good morning.
Happy to have you here. I also have Bill Falsey, the former municipal manager for Anchorage, who recently ran for mayor with a very robust platform plank about early childhood education. And that's what drew my attention to you, Bill. I was like, wow, you know, it's perhaps going to become a bigger part of what of the municipality, perhaps with your leadership there. And then we also have Hillary Seitz, who's a professor of early childhood education at UAA, who focuses a lot on equality of child care and early education. So I'll tell you a little bit more about our listeners once we get started on the program, but I do want to welcome our audience to participate. We did reach out to a couple of child care providers to let them know the program was on the air in case they wanted to weigh in from the trenches, you know, on their thoughts if we're talking about things that interest them. And the number you can call here in Anchorage is 550-8433. And, you know, I know that THREAD is a statewide organization and we may get callers from outside of the Anchorage area. So that's 1-888-353-5752. And then I'll just monitor our email here at hometown@alaskapublic.org. That's hometown@alaskapublic.org in case folks send in any email questions, because we do have a bit of a brain trust here on how early childhood education and learning might be different. I also would suggest to people that go to hometown at alaskapublic.org/hometown, which is our promo page for this show. And we do have a lot of links there that are interesting and relevant to today's topic, including several to the THREAD website, which is, you know, honestly, Stephanie, I think of that THREAD website as almost a think tank. I mean, you know, I know that you connect parents to childcare. You help providers expand their skills, but there's also kind of a think tank quality to your website. There's a lot of information, including a dashboard where you can look at costs and needs and all kinds of things. So that we have links to that on alaskapublic.org/hometown. One more thing before we jump in, I just want to alert our audience that next Monday, May 3rd, on Hometown Alaska, we're going to have a mayoral debate between Forrest Dunbar and Dave, oh my goodness, his it just flipped out of my mind. Our other candidate,
Dave Bronson.
Thank you, Dave Bronson. I keep wanting to say Carlson. So Dave Bronson and Forrest Dunbar here on Hometown Alaska. It will be live. We will, you know, be doing questions and rebuttals, and we are also looking for questions from the audience, and we invite you to send them in to hometown@alaskapublic.org. That's our email address, hometown@alaskapublic.org. So we'll be noticing that throughout the week, and it's an important election on May 11th, and we just want to do our part to give the candidates an opportunity to talk to citizens in Anchorage. Okay, so back to what we were really here to talk about today, which is early childhood education and, you know, basically, I want to spend just a tiny bit more on our guests so that you know the background that they have. Just very briefly, Hillary Seitz with UAA, I found on your university webpage, Hillary, you joined the UAA Early Childhood Program faculty in January of 2003, and you came to that role with 17 years of early childhood teaching experience from infant, toddler, preschool classrooms, public pre-K, and elementary grades for 3 years, and your research has been in early literacy development, collaborative practices between families and schools, and various other aspects of developing child care. So, Hillary, I just want to say thanks, and I just am going to also tell you a little bit more about Bill Falsey. I mentioned that he was both the attorney for the City of Anchorage for almost 2.5 years, and then the city manager for 3 years, and, you know, overseeing huge, huge municipal workforce, 1,500 employees, $300 million in annual budgets, and 9 departments. And Bill studied physics as an undergrad at Stanford, and minored in history and political science, and has a Yale law degree. And he went to Diamond High School. It's always fun to talk about your local roots, so Diamond High School. And finally, Stephanie, I found a little bit more information about you. You're the CEO of Thread, and you oversee a network of partner organizations helping to strengthen access to quality early care and learning in Alaska. You have experience working on social public policy, creating innovative partnerships, and improving the quality of service in Alaska. And you have a master's in social work and a bachelor of applied science in psychology. And you live here in Anchorage. So that is our panel. And as I say, they are the experts, and I'm here to facilitate a conversation with them about the state of early childhood education in Alaska and in Anchorage. So I'm going to start with our questions. I told our audience, or our guests before the show, that we seem to be at a moment, a kind of critical moment in childcare, really for two reasons. One, COVID, we seem to have come to an understanding of the critical value of childcare. The stories across the nation were, you know, women dropping out of the workforce because they didn't have childcare. But there's also the persistent problem of low-paid wages and, you know, childcare centers sort of on a very delicate balancing act, trying to meet the needs of their clientele, you know, pay their workers and still stay open. And so I'm going to go to Stephanie to tell us a little bit about what's going on in childcare right now here in Anchorage. That's our biggest audience here in South Central. You can touch a little bit on statewide if you want. Are we going to make it through? Did we lose childcare centers during COVID? Are some of them on hold? How many of them tried to offer service throughout the pandemic?
Well, thank you again, Kathleen, for bringing this topic to the forefront for all of us and for all of your listeners. I really appreciate the attention to it. And you're right, we are in a moment. And whether we're in COVID or not, Thread often talks about the main issues of childcare in three different kind of levers and areas. And you've talked about those already. And one is access. The other is affordability. And the third is quality. So already before COVID, you know, all of those issues were a challenge in the childcare marketplace. And when COVID struck all of us over a year ago, that we saw, you know, different points and pulling points, you know, in each of those areas. So at the height of the pandemic, we saw about 50% of the programs temporarily close. For people who don't know, childcare across the state was that never mandated to close or open, but recommended to follow CDC guidelines, which included some mitigation strategies to ensure, of course, you know, the health and safety of everyone in care and our workforce. So since the height of pandemic, so since last summer, we've seen more programs continue to open and reopen. And right now, we're really excited to have more than 90% of our licensed and regulated programs open across the state, and that's also true here in Anchorage. The remaining ones that are still temporarily closed are some of our school-age programs and also some programs that may be connected to other infrastructure, maybe in a faith-based building or other kind of connected to other buildings or facilities that may limit some of their ability to fully open at this time. So, you know, I just want to acknowledge the early childhood programs and the workforce, they have absolutely been frontline workers through all of this, and I believe have not been recognized as such and really have been unsung heroes for supporting families when they needed it the most. And as we all know, and we all pivoted, you know, many of us to work from home, that this has been a really stressful time. Many families, of course, have taken on all of the different hats and roles of parenting and schooling and caregiving in very different ways than we were all used to before. And that meant the child care programs themselves have had to pivot as well. So I think the biggest struggle has been, you know, the child care model, which I know we'll talk about, of how they make their money is through tuition and revenue. And without that, or seeing dramatic declines in that, we saw the industry become more fragile than it was even before. So through mitigation planning and requirements through the municipality, which were put in place for health and safety reasons, but also recommended by the CDC, required programs to have, you know, fewer, just a smaller capacity. So they were able to only able to serve, you know, a smaller amount of children and smaller groups. So that limited their income, which, of course, at the same time, required them to increase some of their operating costs, including more staffing, more training, more health and safety supplies, including PPE, you know, taking time to put those mitigation plans in place. So at the same time their operating costs were increasing, their revenue was decreasing, which left a major gap. So the industry has been very fragile. We've been working over the last year to help them with focusing on stabilization, including trying to find some financial support. But the good news is we have seen very few temporarily or permanently close, I think, as you asked. And we've actually seen some new programs start that have offset the number that have closed. So we are maintaining some of that capacity here in Anchorage, but are still seeing vacancies in programs because there still seems to be a temporary kind of lull in demand as families, you know, are still shifting and pivoting into kind of moving back into work and life.
Mm-hmm. I believe that I read that there's some legislation in coming out of the Commerce and Labor, House Commerce and Labor Committee, you know, sort of trying to bolster early childhood education in the state. And also that, you know, the other moment that I was thinking we're at is it almost feels like a tidal wave of support might be coming down the pipeline, again, kind of thanks to the pandemic, because there's CARES money that's still flowing into the state. And I think I read that some of that is potentially going to go to child care centers, sort of like to support them, you know, March, April, and May. They could be getting like a monthly stipend to sort of help them. That's one thing. But there's also the American Relief Act, which is coming down from Congress. And if I have the numbers right, it's something like $79 billion flowing to specifically for child care. There are many, there's other money, but $79 billion is for child care. And I think I read that in Alaska, that may translate into $39 million. So anyway, I mean, some people speak about this as a moment of transformation, the possibility that finally the investment might be there for early childhood. My worry is that once the money is gone, will we be back to where we are today? So I guess I would go to you, Stephanie, to talk a little bit about that, and maybe Hillary, because you're probably watching the national political climate and movements to try to support early childhood education. So, Stephanie, just a bit about that. Do you know very much? I want to spend a little time later in the program talking about when that money comes here, or how do we know where it's going to go. But do I have this right that we are looking kind of at a tidal wave of support for child care?
Yes, that is right. So between the second and third federal stimulus packages, for the allocation for child care alone is estimated to be about $90 million for Alaska. And you're right, a majority of that is set aside at the federal level to ensure stabilization grants to child care programs. So the state is currently in a planning process right now, so we don't have a lot of information about that. But it is a moment of opportunity, and the moment is twofold, is really to provide relief and recovery for the child care programs as they've been struggling, as I just mentioned. While they remain open, they still remain very fragile. And the last time we surveyed programs earlier in the winter, you know, over 50% still say they, you know, may have to close in the next year without considerable financial support. So we're very optimistic about the opportunity that the federal dollars can offer that much needed relief during this time. And the moment also is that, you know, there's more public understanding about the need for quality early childhood. There's more understanding about the long-term outcomes that we can all benefit from and see when we invest in early childhood. And the, I guess one of the silver linings of COVID has been that more businesses are aware of their families and with young children and how that's impacting their workforce and ability to support their employees. So there is a moment where we can have you know, a recovery conversation, but also a forward-facing conversation about how can we do better to support this in essential infrastructure for two workforces, really, well, three workforces, the current parents who are working, so how we're, you know, engaging and partnering with businesses as they're employing working families, and how we're supporting working families, but then our future workforce of our youngest citizens as well.
Yeah. Let me just, if you just joined Hometown Alaska, we are talking about early childhood education and learning here in Anchorage and Alaska, and, you know, how it struggled through COVID and what opportunities might be there for stabilization and maybe even innovation, perhaps, with federal dollars that are coming through the American Relief Act. So our guests are Stephanie Berglund, the CEO of Thread, Bill Falsey, a former Anchorage municipal manager, and Professor Hillary Seitz. And again, if you are a parent who struggled through COVID, there were some interesting stories in the paper about a couple that were both nurses and how they had an infant and how they had to change their schedules to somebody always had to be home because they didn't have childcare. I imagine there are a million stories like that out there in Anchorage, but also, you know, providers who have struggled to keep their feet on the ground and serve their families. We welcome you to give us a call at 550-8433. Hillary, I just want to go to you quickly to say, what does it mean to you? You're someone who focuses on quality of childcare. Does this moment seem critical to you that we might be turning a corner on, you know, just childcare versus quality childcare?
Yeah, thank you for having me. And I'm happy to be having this conversation right now because it is a pivotal time, as you mentioned, Kathleen. So going back to those three levers that Stephanie mentioned, the access, the affordability, and quality. And at the university, we really focus on how do we support a quality early learning environment in our community, which includes all types of childcare, as well as pre-elementary programs, which might be pre-K or preschool in public schools, all the way up through third grade, and what that looks like, you know, in terms of quality for families and the children that are in those programs. So quality indicators are many things, you know, so those are what we want to see in any type of early care and learning setting. So if it's a home care, you want to think about what is the learning environment, what is the interaction level that's happening between the caregiver, you know, what type of program are they offering? And then as you move into more of a center-based care, it becomes a little bit more formalized in thinking about your curriculum, thinking about how you engage families, thinking about your stable workforce. And then pre-elementary, some of those same things, but the education level does change for that teacher of a three-year-old or four-year-old that's in one of those pre-elementary programs. They're expected to have the same teacher background that if you're a public school teacher with a teaching license. And in your teacher preparation, you're learning about all of these aspects of quality. So it changes a little bit depending on what age group you're working with or what type of setting you're in.
Okay. You know, we are going to come back and talk a little bit with Bill Falsey. Partly I want to ask you, Bill, why the heck was it so important to you when you were running for mayor that this be one of your planks? And also I want to, you know, in the second section, talk a little bit more about the questions that the public might have, like why is it so expensive? Why are childcare workers so poorly paid? You know, why can't we meet the need? So we are going to come right back and talk more about early childhood education. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. For more information about this episode, visit us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. We're talking early childhood education with Stephanie Berglund from THRED, Bill Falsey, a former municipal manager for Anchorage, who had a strong plank about early childhood education when he ran for mayor, and Professor Hillary Seitz, an early childhood education professor at UAA. I'm going to begin with you, Bill. I just wanted to say, why was it so important to you to put that in your mayoral platform? I suspect you were living the reality of a difficult childcare in your own home, but why did you think it was important enough to put it in the platform?
Yeah, well, thanks, Kathleen, and I really appreciate the chance to come on and continue this conversation. I come to this conversation slightly different perspective from Hillary and from Stephanie, and I find my way to it first as a consumer, where just as a parent of young children in a two-parent working household, I crashed into that reality that everyone rediscovers, that parents pay a lot, the teachers make very little, and often childcare isn't even available. And then just got interested in that as someone who was looking to find a place for our kids so that both my wife and I could continue in the workforce. And then spun off of that to become very interested in the topic as a policymaker, not only because I sort of better understood what was really driving that reality, but also because it just really seemed like both an occasion where our local institutions have not kept pace with the new world, that we're sort of still set up in a model that all but forces one parent out of the workforce for the younger years of a child's development. And second, that we're sort of leaving money on the table, that the social returns from not investing in expanded quality early childhood education are so high that we're sort of saving ourselves poor by not entering into this space.
Mm-hmm. That brings me to really what I was hoping. You know, when I think about people who come to this, Bill, you hit it, you know, as a parent. But some people, you know, they're standing a bit to the side of this, and they're like, or maybe they're involved in it like you were, but they're like, why am I paying so much? One of the details I read was that, and I think this is true in Anchorage, that you can be paying as much for a year of childcare as, or even more for a year of childcare than you might be paying at the public university for a year of tuition. So, you know, it's kind of a stunning amount. And if you have two children or more, how are you going to do that? So I want to talk a little bit about why it is so expensive. And I want to talk a little bit about why childcare workers are so low paid. And then the unmet need. I guess I think understanding. I think I read a number that there are 90,000 children in Alaska under the age of 13, and about half of them need, there's an unmet need there. That's statewide. But first, let's talk a little bit about why it is so expensive. And I'm going to go to you, Stephanie, because I know you've done a lot of research on this. So help us out. Why is it so expensive?
Well, it's expensive because our children, you know, need to be taken care of, and they need to be taken care of by adults who are highly skilled, and this is, you know, a really high-touch service. It's not something that can be outsourced, and
We, you know, want to honor the way to do it in a quality way, like Hillary was talking about, to ensure that our environments are not only just safe and healthy, but also really enriched with curriculum and positive interaction. And that means having, you know, ratios in place and group size numbers in place for how many teachers are with, you know, different ages of children at any given time. So the cost model is such that when you think of all of the regular business costs of space and utilities and but add, you know, curriculum, food and materials that often we call consumables because, you know, children play with toys and like to chew on books, and those things need to be replaced on a regular basis. But the biggest cost in childcare is the people and the workforce. And unfortunately, you know, why they are not able to be paid as much, because when you look at the entire budget of a program and compared to what parents can afford, we've already acknowledged multiple times that childcare is very expensive for a family. Right now in Anchorage, the average is 17% of a family's household is being spent on childcare. For single moms, that's, you know, just under 40%. I mean, that is not affordable for anybody. Mm-hmm. But for the amount that programs are collecting in tuition to honor the health and safety and ratios, you know, compared to the cost of a program budget, where they can make the market work for themselves is in the people, because it's the most, the largest part of the budget. And so a way to keep costs down is unfortunately to pay a low wage and offer very minimal benefits. So mm-hmm. the average wage right now of early educators is, you know, around $12 an hour without benefits. So that equates to less than $25,000 a year, which is not a livable or thriving wage. And we know many early educators are themselves utilizing public assistance and struggle with stressors to support their own families.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a broken system, and one we are very excited about talking about solutions to fix.
Mm-hmm. And Hillary, anything to add there?
No, I would reiterate all of those things that Stephanie said. I mean, it's a really challenging time. I see it from the workforce side of educating them at the university. And most of my students are working professionals. I mean, they're working in childcare facilities or running their own home childcare program, or that's what they want to do. And they're trying to better themselves, but they've come from very difficult situations themselves and have their own children. That they're, you know, trying to figure out the same things that Bill mentioned, you know, how do I take care of them, and they don't have the resources to do what they even want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's mm-hmm. a really challenging time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Kathleen, I think I would underscore the math behind this, because it becomes a very complicated story when you think about all the things that go into it. But if you step very far away and just model it as a black box, what is the business model that we have required of our child care providers? Right now, the money comes in attached to the students. It is a tuition payment. And we require child care caregiver ratios for very good reasons. So to make this concrete, imagine in your head what amount of money you think would be reasonable for an early child care provider who is overseeing a room of 12-month-old to 18-month-olds. What amount of money should they be reasonably paid and compensated for their skills? Well, right now, by law, they can only have 5 children in their group. So whatever that number is, divided by 5, and that's the amount of money our current system says has to come in just through the tuition payments. And that's not all going to the teacher. That's going to be covering lease space and heating and overhead and all the other things that Stephanie mentioned. So we have this economic model where we have throttled the number of payers for very good reasons, because we're not going to have a room of 1-year-olds where their child care ratio is 20-1. The essential economy of scale is just not there. And it means, I think, that there is a public good that could be provided in a way that is not just this market system that we have now.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I looked at, I read a lot of articles about, you know, why is it so expensive? And one of them I read in The Atlantic was from 2019, so it's a couple years old, but it was literally why childcare is so ridiculously expensive. And among some of the things they talked about was that, you know, Americans might not have made the transition from, okay, we know that we pay for public school. There's debate about that. Some people want vouchers, different things like that. They want to take their tax dollars and put it someplace else. But we have had a public school system, and we have public universities, and people can get that, but they haven't fully grasped the idea that from age 1 through 5, there's also a public need. They haven't seen it as a public need that they should support. And I think that's just really interesting. Something else I read about was also that, other countries have spent much more on childcare than we do. And I think the example I saw was France and Denmark spend 3 to 5 times more on their young children's care and education. And that we lack a national solution, and that's kind of an indictment of our American policy, that we just haven't, we've learned so much about the brain, right, from birth to these early years, where so much is happening in the brain, and it could potentially set the tone for the experience in school and, resiliency and all kinds of things like that. And yet we still haven't quite thought to ourselves that maybe this is a community good that we should support. And I guess, I'm going to go to you, Stephanie, because you probably study these things. People might be thinking, oh my gosh, the government's going to take over childcare and, it'll be heavily regulated and very expensive. What do you say to people when they say that to you?
Well, I just want to comment and thank you for your comments, because I think you articulated all of the issues really well. And to build off of that, I think the answer is exactly what Bill said earlier, that this is a public good, and I think we need to think differently about how childcare is actually a really critical component and lever for our infrastructure and our economy. And I think at the end of the day, we think about, what is it that we all want in our community? We want quality of life. We want our families to borrow the slogan, right? Live, work, and play here. And in order to do so, part of that means they need to be able to make a living, support their families. And one of the critical pieces that includes is how we're all supporting childcare. So it's not just about the government. I think the government is a major player in this. We need government to continue. They are currently the ones who are regulating safe and healthy childcare. So they are the ones who provide the licensing and regulation requirements, which is a good thing. So our children are safe and healthy and well cared for where they are. And but beyond that, there's an opportunity for more community solutions. How are we looking at business involvement? There's a great role that businesses can be playing from rethinking their family-friendly policies. If anything, COVID, like I mentioned earlier, has really, I think, made businesses more aware of this issue for their workforce. So how can we engage businesses more? We did some work with families during the pandemic, and it was really interesting. The number one thing that they said that they needed and wanted support with was from a role that their employer can play, so more flexibility, there's some financial support employers can provide relative to their childcare needs. So there's great opportunity for businesses to be a part of the solution, for government to play a larger role, and really for our community to really think creatively and come up with solutions that will work for us at a local level to support where families have the most need.
Yeah. I'm going to welcome a listener on to our program. We have Barb Dubovich with Campfire. Welcome, Barb.
Good morning.
And I see, just I have a little note here that you're talking about after-school programs and learning loss that, of course, we're talking about because of the disrupted school system and online learning and all the change that happened this year. So go ahead and tell us. I believe you are maybe the director of Campfire.
I am. I'm the CEO of the agency, and I'm greatly appreciative of this dialogue and discussion. So thank you for hosting it. Folks have already covered, some really significant important topics. I just want to add to the discussion around the need for school age care before and after school, during break times, during those summer months. And, of course, our families have had, you know, tremendous disruption in this last year and are still sort of recovering from that and trying to determine what their needs will be. But within the, you know, early childhood stretch, you know, as Hillary, I think, mentioned, you know, it goes up to third grade, up to age eight. And the needs of those younger students, as well as actually kids that are 9, 10, 11, 12, you know, they don't automatically move into caring for themselves at those ages. They still need care. Families still need support before and after school and during those summer months when they're working outside the home. But this year, particularly in working with the school district and working with principals and teachers and just beginning to understand the tremendous amount of learning loss for some of our students in our district and what that has meant and how our programs support that and help support families with ongoing, you know, educational support. Our programs, you know, when you start to enter school and they're actually in a formal classroom with teachers, before and after school programs like Campfire, Boys and Girls Club, YMCA, and many others, I want to be really inclusive, really support the social and emotional learning that that age group needs and is significantly important for that age group. But we are now trying to make sure that we're also supporting just that cognitive learning and particularly the loss for many of our students here in Anchorage. And I think I just want to add that, you know, with the funding that's coming down the road, we have an opportunity here to ensure that funds are being distributed in an equitable manner so that those in greatest need can we can increase access for them. Affordability, I think Stephanie mentioned really early on, affordability and accessibility are really important to families with care. But for those families that are economically challenged, it's even more so an issue. And so as we go forward, I think it's really important that we include a comprehensive way of looking at meeting all kids' needs and ensuring they have access.
Mm-hmm. What's the story with Campfire? Were you able to remain open, or were you, or was it a mixed bag of some openings and some closings?
It is a mixed bag. Was a mixed bag. Remains a mixed bag.
Okay.
A number of things going on. Initially, as you know, the pandemic hit, we were able to reorg, and we did offer several emergency child care opportunities for families that were first responder. We went into providing care for first responder families last April and May. Then we shifted into our summer mode, and we were able to offer three licensed child care programs for school-age youth, as well as our day camp, which is an accredited camp, Camp Silamio on APU campus. And so we were operating under, you know, lower numbers, higher ratios, additional staff, all of the things that Stephanie listed as increased cost for the agency. We moved into the school year. We maintained full-day child care opportunities for youth. We opened in a new partnership with the Anchorage School District and United Way. We opened three licensed full-day centers at three schools that are Title I schools that are economically challenged and provided actually educational support through the day, worked with teachers from those schools to be sure the students who really needed access to their education were able to get that, got care, received breakfast and lunch. Those programs are actually also continuing right now in a before and after school manner, with actually staff staying within the school day to help support particular students, and those are actually being funded through outside funds, funders and support that we've been able to receive. And we believe actually those programs are going to, there's a need for even more of those programs as we continue. But overall, the agency is serving about 25 to 30% of number of individual youth compared to pre-COVID. So substantial reduction, right?
Which
what
means
we're hearing today from our families is, you know, they're making summer plans or programs are filling for the summer, but they're really curious. They keep asking questions about, you know, what's the fall plan? What's the fall plan? And, are you going to be at my school? Are you going to be able to open here? You hear a lot of stress, anxiety for families, uncertainty still. You know, we feel like we're coming out of the pandemic. It's not 100%. People are getting used to having their kids back in the school day. They're not necessarily sure what their employer is going to say to them about you can work remote, you can't work remote, mm-hmm. you part remote, you know.
Yeah.
For the agency, we are we've been stabilized through those stimulus monies. We wouldn't have made it, quite frankly, without those funding sources, and we won't be able to continue without those funding sources.
Or build back up to where you the service that you were providing it's really stunning that you're only able right now to meet for many different reasons. Perhaps people are staying home, working from home, and they can keep their children home, but. Anyway, Barb, thank you so much for calling. And we're going to take another tiny break. And when we come back, I guess I'd like to talk about two things. One is I've read that, you know, the benefits of the early childhood education actually end up potentially leading to these children grow up and they do better in school and they, you know, get work training and education and become really successful and get higher paying jobs and therefore are paying more tax money into the system. And that's one reason why people should be thinking about this in the long term. But also even in the short term here, talking about, you know, the Anchorage School District frets quite a bit about its reading standards in fourth grade. And I that might come back and talk to you a little bit, Hillary, about the connection between not being ready for school and what happens once you are in school. But we need to take a tiny break. So I'm going to say thank you to Barb and to our audience. You are listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. You can find Hometown Alaska on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. Our topic is early childhood learning and child care with Stephanie Berglund, the CEO of Thread, Bill Falzy, and Professor Hillary Seitz. I guess the thrust of my question now is sort of if you don't pay for it at the front end, you pay for it at the back end. And by that I mean if children are not yet ready for school when they arrive, and all of that learning, that learning how to read, that learning how to do everything that you need to do to be successful in school, if it doesn't take, then you're looking at a whole series of potential issues where, for example, reading scores are not where you would want them to be. High school graduation isn't where you want it to be. People's opportunities in life aren't where you want them to be. Is it too much of a stretch? And I'll go to you, Hillary, but is it too much of a stretch to look at these early years as so significantly fundamental that if you don't give the support then, you literally will be paying for it down the road? Can you address that, Hillary?
Sure, yes. Well, you know, brain researchers have found that 90% of the brain is developed between birth through age 5. So if we think about that, you know, the child, that's when they're ripe to learn, when they're just taking everything in and their experiences and their environment and their interactions with children, with other adults, with their environment, that's when it's going to have the most impact. And so we want to try to have the best opportunities for children during this time period. I think you mentioned, Kathleen, that, you know, other countries are putting significantly more money into this. And what that means is they've set up programs that provide really rich environments, really highly educated teachers that understand what child development looks like, that understand ways to intervene when necessary to catch things before they become an issue later down the road, and to support all families and all children in their classrooms. So, you know, we can help children be much more ready for the system that we have here right now. Right now, our school system, our public school system, begins at age 5 for kindergarten. And, you know, we're looking at different ways we can have pre-elementary programs, and there already are many schools that have preschool programs that start at age 4, some even down to 3. Head Start was developed with this in mind to support an easier transition for children coming up through childcare and preschool programs so that they could be more successful and to help the families understand what those school structures are like and what expectations would be for that as well. And there are many things, childcare, preschool programs, or just early childhood programs, even school age programs, there are many things that all of these programs can be doing to support more success in the public school system. If you mentioned the reading skills, there are really 6 early literacy skills that predict reading and writing success that we could be working on with every child first to age 5. I mean, those are just talking to children, learning how to tell a story, using words and vocabulary, just thinking about what letters and numbers look like and becoming aware of that, reading to your child every single day, many times during that day, and having children become excited about that. All of those things can happen or do happen in high-quality programs and in family environments as well. But all of those things help success when children enter that kindergarten, that more official start to public school education. You know, we can start that. We're starting to think about how we push that back, like I said, to those preschool programs and the pre-elementary programs in schools so that we have an easier transition. And it's not such a shock to the child that didn't have those same structures or same expectations, and for the families, those same shocks of when children start school at age 5.
Mm-hmm. And when it's their first experience. Bill, I want to go to you because I talked you into coming on the program because you did such a formidable job when I was talking to you about, well, here's the ways that we can pay for this, because I think the price tag is a thing that the public looks at, and that's why I was trying to draw the connection between if you might pay for it now or you might pay for it later, you know, but there's a cost to the overall good if our children aren't ready for, you know, the world that they're going to have to face. So do you think that's a good thing to cover right now? Because I do think the price tag still sticks in people's minds and they're thinking, I'm already paying for all this other stuff. How can I pay for this too? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And I will say that that is one of the things that really piqued my interest in this whole conversation. I think there's a body of literature that I'm sure Hillary is much more fluent in than I am, but that I'm aware of with the James Heckman equation and Professor Timothy Bartok out of Michigan and all of those folks who have attempted to array the social benefits that you get from an early investment in early childhood education. And, I think it depends on how you're doing the studies, but all of them say that it's a very positive payback, but it's mostly a social return. So you see things like reduced prison enrollments and better economic performance from people, but that's all down the road. It's hard to finance a program based on trying to take those returns and bring them forward. But a few cities have experimented with a different thing, which was more financeable, which was Chicago and Salt Lake City found that they believed they had a story that there was a number of students who entered into the kindergarten program so far behind that they needed remedial education and IEPs, individual education plans, very expensive. And if they could forward fund a pre-K intervention, they would eliminate the need for those near-term costs. And so Chicago and Salt Lake City just borrowed the funds through a social impact bond pay-for-success type model. And it would certainly be worth looking into whether we have a similar story on that front. And that really was an exercise in taking tomorrow's costs and getting ahead of them today.
Mm-hmm. Good. I just think it's kind of interesting to think about that, because sometimes we forget what we're already paying for. And if we didn't have to pay for that and we were paying for this up front and sort of launching kids with stronger legs for moving through the system, it's just kind of an interesting thing to think about.
And I'll also say, Kathleen, too, that a lot of times these conversations focus very narrowly on the child's performance. Of course, that's central. That's very key to the whole reason why we're interested in all of this. But there are all sorts of knock-on benefits that we have understood that go beyond just the child, too. When Washington, D.C. expanded universal childhood or early education for four-year-olds. It saw double-digit employment increases in single mothers, for instance. And this is a lesson that we understood as a country long ago. There was a brief period where there was a substantial federal investment in pre-K, and that was 1943 to 1946 because we needed rosy riveting, and everyone understood that was essential to having that work. Mm-hmm. And so just even beyond children, looking at sort of the knock-on effects for the parents of the children, too, and the economic activity that it can generate, it becomes a pretty compelling story.
Mm-hmm. Right. I know I read, too, that, you know, originally childcare was, you know, mom's job at home. She wasn't necessarily paid for it. And now it's just a different understanding because mom's working if she can and wants to. And yet now there is the cost of the care that she was providing at no cost to her family, right? I guess we have about 7 or 8 minutes left. And I kind of want to return to the topic of this sort of tidal wave of support that's about to come in. And I know, Stephanie, I talked with you a little bit about it. You said we really don't know. And I think Hillary, you said we don't really know. But I want to know, how can the public, you know, how do we know who's at the table deciding how the money is going to be? I think it's going to be a state allocation and it will move through the state. But is there a task force or some way where people who are, you know, working in childcare can influence what happens? And I'm going to go to you, Stephanie, and you may not have a lot to offer there because it's so new.
Yeah, thank you for the question. And there is a large amount of federal stimulus making its way to Alaska to support child care. And there is opportunity, as always, for people to weigh in. And I would encourage them to contact the Child Care Programs Office at the state level to offer that input. But I think while that is helpful, much of the dollars have intent language from the law coming from the federal government. And much of that is set aside for grants that will go to early childhood education programs and child care to help them with costs to support them in stabilizing their operations. And also there is a significant set aside for families. And, you know, I think it's worth, underscoring the affordability issues for families. And in COVID, of course, we've seen that become more of an issue for families as many households have maybe lost employment or seen a reduction in hours in their employment. That makes childcare even less affordable than it was for them before when they are maybe wanting to move back into the workforce. But looking at how we can make childcare more affordable for families and with some of these stimulus dollars, maybe testing a few models for, you know, paying maybe some higher subsidy support and how we can help offset the cost for families so that it can be something that they can achieve. I think just parent choice is a major issue, and I can't underscore enough that, and Bill touched on this for his own family, that it's a struggle to not only find a space for your child, but also one that is something you feel like your family can afford and is of the quality that you desire. And I've been at Thread now for 15 years and have yet to meet a family that all three of those elements are true for them. And cost is the biggest barrier for families. So when you think about how we can level that playing field, and as Barb talked about earlier, really support those maybe who have the greatest need of access, who are would benefit most from that environment. We need to look at ways we can make that more affordable for families.
Mm-hmm. You know, we have a couple minutes left, and I'm going to go to you, Hillary. What would you like our audience to be thinking about? We've spent the hour talking about, you know, surviving COVID with our early childhood programs somewhat intact, but they were fragile anyway. But going forward, you know, you're an early childhood education professor. What would you want parents and families to be thinking about at this moment?
Oh, gosh, there's so many different things. You know, as myself, as a parent, you know, when I had to think about where my children went, I wanted them to be healthy and safe. You know, I wanted them to love learning. I wanted them to be happy, because if I knew they were anxious or stressed out or feeling unsafe, then I felt that way too, and I couldn't perform in my own job. So I guess for families, I want to have enough opportunities and places that are of high quality that meet their needs in our community. And I just looking at my own students who are working in these programs, they're struggling with those same issues. And so I know this is widespread in our community, that people don't feel like they have those good choices to make, that they can find a place where their children are happy and love learning and they can afford it. And they feel like it's helping them, so they'll do better in school or be successful in school. And just the daily stress of life is, you know, just figuring out how that balance works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to you, Bill, what, you know, given the amount of work you did locally to look at this and to think of solutions, what would you like the audience to be thinking about?
I think I'll leave you with two thoughts. The first, to pick up on the conversation we had earlier about thinking about early childhood education as a kind of infrastructure that's delivering public goods. You know, early kind of in the nation's history, when we came to road constructions, often we would leave it to private corporations. They'd build the road and then they'd charge a toll to use it. But we decided that's just not the best way to deliver roads in the United States. In the same way, leaving early childhood education, pre-K, to private organizations, which are going to struggle for the reasons we talked about, saying you got to pay to play, is not the best way to deliver the system. And the second thing I'll pass along is that we do have some pre-K in ASD right now, federally funded, mostly in the Title I schools, where there are students who qualify for free and reduced price lunches. Something like 375 kids in those programs, and there are just as many and more, up to 470, on the wait list for the programs. And that just doesn't seem equitable. It seems like we have now had a system where only parents of means can really reliably find a place to get their children delivered services and to stay in the workforce. And we should take a step back, look at that, and say, are we comfortable with that? And I think the answer is no, and that we can do better.
Mm-hmm. And I'll go to you last, Stephanie. We have about a minute or so. I from reading on the Thread website, all your, you know, analysis and everything, it sounds like you're not suggesting one size fits all solution here, that there's a blend of things, whether it's some government programs, some employer programs, some marketplace programs. So could you talk a little bit about why you think there's no one silver bullet?
Well, I think it comes down to parental choice, right? All of our kids are not the same, and all of our families maybe want something different. So looking at how we can offer solutions that meet families' needs for the number of hours they need, you know, for they want it part day or full day, and something that they can afford, and as Hillary mentioned, you know, has the learning components or social emotional components, or maybe another unique aspect that they're looking for in an early child experience for them and their families. Often our early educators are an extension of our family and part of that village that's helping to raise all of our children. And it's really important that we acknowledge that workforce, support them, and treat them that way.
All right. Well, when you hear the music, you know we're out of time. So I have to say thank you to our callers and listeners today, and especially to Stephanie Berglund from Thread, Bill Falsey, and Hillary Seitz. And next Monday on Hometown Alaska, tune in for a mayoral debate. Candidates Dave Bronson and Forrest Dunbar will take your questions, and they'll pose questions to each other, and also we hope to have questions from the public to ask them. Email them this week to hometown@alaskapublic.org, and we hope to get as many as we can. Find us on the web at alaskapublic.org. Dave Emmert was our audio engineer today. Thanks for joining us on Hometown Alaska.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.